asylum in Greece since 22. So I may not recall exactly the numbers, but I think in 23 there was around 48,000 people that arrived, newly registered asylum seekers. 24, I think it's above 60, 62, if I'm not saying something wrong. So the increase is not that enormous. And we are really far from the numbers of 2015 or 2016. I think that's also very clear. But yet, we really see a steady increase year after year since 22. And that's also something that we see on the ground, because although the numbers are not that high, there is this increase, and it is completely overwhelming the system in place.
Percent are men, 99% are women, and 38% are children. The population in the camp is way above the official capacity, which forces people to live in areas that are not accommodated for living. So the population in the camp is way above the official capacity. So people are forced to live in areas that are not suitable for accommodation. So living conditions are really appalling. So we can see people living in the floor with no blankets. There is pest infestation, some toilets and some bathroom being flooded or broken. That is really not suitable for the person, and even more for the more vulnerable one. So this living condition will really contribute to the spread of preventable diseases, especially skin diseases, gastrointestinal illness, and respiratory infection. And as we say, there is very vulnerable people within the camp, including children.
Clashes with the Coast Guard often occur, further increasing the danger of the journey and placing migrants in a difficult position between the hope of reaching safely and the threats from authorities. The journey itself, although seemingly just a maritime trip between two points, represents a continuous challenge for survival and is usually followed by great suffering for the migrants in terms of humanitarian conditions and basic needs.
The sea is dangerous, but the bigger danger is not in it, but in the coast guards who chase us. Even if the waves are high, we can cross with the skill of the captain, but the problem lies with the Turkish and Greek naval patrols. If we don't stop for them, they deliberately sink the boats. Their goal is to stop migration by any means. That is why people are forced to sail, even in the toughest weather conditions, because the coast guards do not appear during storms. I attempted to cross the sea 8 times and saw death each time. Many children, women and young people have lost their lives because of the coast guards, who shoot at us, take our belongings, and then send us back into the water, where we wait for the Turkish Navy to rescue us.
The Greek islands are a key crossing point for illegal migrants, especially islands like Lesbos, Chios, and Samos. These islands are located near the Turkish coasts, making them initial stops for many migrants attempting to reach Europe. From there, many try to continue their journey to other countries like Germany, France, and Sweden. Unfortunately, migrants often face risks during these trips, such as drowning due to unsafe boats or being arrested by Greek or European authorities. Additionally, the Greek islands face immense pressure due to the continuing increase in migrant numbers, which impacts their resources and creates social and economic challenges.
I didn't choose Samos Island, but I chose Greece because it is the only passageway to Europe, specifically Germany and Belgium. Our goal was not to stay in Greece, but to transit to our final destination.
The policy of detention on Greek islands has faced severe criticism from humanitarian organizations and the international community. The Greek government and European countries that adopt strict policies regarding asylum and migration have been accused of exacerbating the suffering of refugees and migrants in these centers. Many international organizations call for the improvement of detention conditions by reducing overcrowding, transferring refugees to better centers, providing necessary health care for all detainees, ensuring the protection of human rights, and providing a safe environment for women and children.
We hear stories constantly about how the violence is affecting the well-being and the psychological state of the people, but we also hear a lot how being contained in camps that resemble a prison, with this very high level of security, with the barbed wires on the top of the fence, so many security officers everywhere, how it's also in a way re-traumatizing them again. So we address, from a psychological point of view, those sufferings. And one challenge actually is to find the balance between having a one-off session and a longer psychological support, because people also don't necessarily stay so long in the camp. Sometimes after a few months, they may be going and being transferred to another camp. So the follow-up is also sometimes an issue in the provision of medical care.
European destinations, particularly countries like Italy, Greece, and Malta, are often the goal for migrants across the Mediterranean. In the absence of legal migration opportunities, many young people turn to traffickers to organize illegal migration trips. These trips continue to present major safety challenges, as many migrants risk drowning or being arrested by European authorities. To limit illegal immigration from the Middle East to Europe requires addressing the root causes of conflicts and disputes in the region. One of the biggest of these issues is the Israeli occupation of Palestine, which contributes to the deterioration of the humanitarian situation in Palestine and the region in general. Achieving peace in West Asia will inevitably lead to improvements in the security and economic situation in the region. There will be no justification for migration. Despite the injustice faced by the Palestinian people at the hands of the Israeli occupation, such as arbitrary arrests, home demolitions, and city blockades, they remain firmly rooted in their land. Resilience has become a part of their daily lives. They confront oppression with hope and cling to their narrative despite attempts to erase it. To them, the land is not just a place, it is history and an undeniable right. With every new generation, the spirit of resistance is renewed, and the determination to remain grows stronger, as if declaring to the world, "We are here, and we will remain." The international community has a responsibility to recognize the rights of the Palestinian people including their right to self-determination and the establishment of an independent Palestinian state. It must exert political and diplomatic pressure to ensure that Israel respects international law. In addition, there is a duty to support legal accountability by backing the efforts of the International Criminal Court in investigating war crimes committed in the Palestinian territories. Providing humanitarian assistance is also essential, particularly for Palestinians in Gaza, the West Bank, and for refugees living abroad.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
Welcome once again to Iran Radio, your trusted companion in thought, spirit, and sound. And we are speaking to you from beautiful capital Tehran. In a world that moves fast, we slow things down, offering space to reflect, learn, and connect. We are honored to have your ears and hearts with us today. Our next program is Leader's Speech. Following that, we're diving into a collection of our radio productions. Next up, we bring you The Key. The program presents short answers to doubts and ambiguities raised about various Islamic and Shia topics. Following that, we have Round the World with reporters. Thank you for being with us. Up next is Leader's Speech.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
حضرت فاطمة عليها السلام is the role model for women throughout history and for all. In her short life, Fatima al-Zahra, peace be upon her, achieved the position as the primary woman of all females. In other words, she is superior to all great and saintly women throughout history. What factors, forces, and what kind of inner strength could lead one person to become such a notion of wisdom, piety, sanctity, and spiritual transcendence in such a short time? This is a miracle of Islam. Another pivotal matter is in regards to the blessed descendants of this great person, Lady Fatima Zahra, peace be upon her. The association of Surah Al-Kawthar with Fatima al-Zahra, peace be upon her, even if such an association had not existed in our collection of hadith, is an accurate association. There are so many blessings that have been bestowed upon the Holy Prophet's household and on each and every one of the Imams, peace be upon them. The world is full of enjoyable individual, social, worldly, and otherworldly melodies which rose from the pure lungs of the Imams, peace be upon them. Hussein ibn Ali, Zainab al-Kubra, Imam Hassan al-Mujtaba, Imam Sadiq, Imam Sajjad, peace be upon them all, each and every one of the Imams would produce these melodies. See, what great excitement exists in the world of spirituality and on the path of guidance because of the words of these great personalities and their lessons and teachings. They are the children of Fatima Zahra, peace be upon her. We should make greater efforts towards emulating Fatima al-Zahra, alayha salam. Lessons to be learned from the life of Siddiqatul Tahira, Fatima al-Zahra, alayha salam, involve making great efforts, showing diligence, and leading a pure life. Just as that great personality, the manifestation of enlightenment and purity, led her life. She was pure, immaculate, virtuous, and pious. Traits of purity, piety, and enlightenment of such an exceptional person are what have influenced our Islamic teachings throughout the history of Shia Islam. In the history of Islam, for every group or stratum of society, there is a suitable role model whose guiding light for salvation and on the path to perfection. The role model for women, as declared by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala and His Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi wa sallam, is Hazrat Fatima Zahra alayha salam. As rightly stated by the noble Prophet, Fatima is the best of all women of the world, Sayyidat Nisa'i al-Alameen, and a role model for all Muslim women. Referring to this, Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayhi said, "The history of Islam is witness to the immense respect that the Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa sallam had for Hazrat Zahra alayha salam, which also powerfully reflects on the importance of women in society. If they are not superior to men, they are definitely not any inferior."
You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've
You make out of my breath, but never my faith, no, never my faith, it's my voice. You may chain both my hands, but never my soul, no, never my soul, it's my voice. You make out of my breath, but never my faith, no, never my faith, it's my voice. You may chain both my hands, but never my soul, no, never my soul, it's my voice.
There's no way to survive, it's your choice.
it's my fault. You mention both my hands, but never my soul. No, never my soul. It's my voice.
There are scholars who delve into the complexities of geopolitics and international relations, examining the forces that shape global dynamics. Their work often bridges theoretical frameworks and practical implications, bringing insights into the interplay of security, economics, and diplomacy. Among them are those who focus on Eurasian integration and the evolving role of conservatism in global politics. My guest today exemplifies this dedication, contributing to academic discourse and shaping perspectives on international affairs. I am Bahman Uray, your host. Welcome to SOAP.
Glenn Deason is a Norwegian political scientist and author born in 1979. He specializes in international relations, geopolitics, geoeconomics, and Russian foreign policy. His academic work often explores the interplay between security institutions, conservatism, and Eurasian integration. Deason has also contributed to journals like Russia in Global Affairs and authored several books on geopolitics and international relations.
Mr. Glenn Deason, it's a pleasure to have you here on SOAP.
Oh, thank you. It's my pleasure.
Thank you. I want to start with what in your childhood or maybe your teen years inspired you to get interested and go after geopolitics and international relations?
Well, I always had a bit of an interest, at least after the Cold War in the 90s. I was quite optimistic about the possibility for Europe to unify, a bit like what I've done with France and Germany, but then, we're bringing in Russia, so having a unified common Europe. When I was in the army in 98, 99, it was a bit of a disappointment to see that we were instead bombing Yugoslavia and creating a Europe without the Russians by expanding NATO. Now, but actually, initially I did a business degree, I had a master of business. I actually moved to Russia almost 20 years ago, to explore commerce, common business interest, and I was swept away by their politics. So that's went back to uni and got re-educated.
Oh, that's interesting. Actually, I wanted to talk to you about, because you pursued degrees in commerce, business, international relations across multiple universities. That's what I wanted to ask. What took you in that path? And tell me, and of course, you speak Russian as well. Tell us about your experience in Russia. What did you find which was maybe different from the mainstream narrative of Russia?
Well, I moved there in 2006 because I wanted to look at some of the common economic interests, because both Norway and Russia, we have fisheries, natural resources. And so I studied there, Russian language and history. And what really took my interest, though, was outside of this, which was the narratives we told, because the stories we tell, what happened after the Cold War, what happened in the 90s, early 2000s, you hear the stories that the Russians say and what's coming out of the West. And we're talking about the same thing, but there's nothing in common. It's completely two different narratives. And often your first instinct is, oh, well, I guess it's, Russians have propaganda. But then, you look into it and you find out that actually their narratives have often more evidence to it. And instead, you find a lot of holes in your own narratives and you realize that, you don't understand your opponents anymore. And when you don't understand your opponents, you tend to pursue very foolish policies. And so I was immediately yeah, took a great interest not just in Russian history but its politics as well.
You know, as a specialist in international relations, of course, why do you think that historically Europe has never been close enough with Russia rather than getting close with America?
Yeah, well, that is the absurd situation we have today, which is also a key flaw in the European security architecture. That is, the main European actor today is the United States, which is a non-European country. Meanwhile, the largest country in Europe in terms of population, territory, economy, military, so across the board, which is Russia. And they're the only country who's now demoted to not even being a European country. So one has to ask oneself, do we really think this is going to lead to stability? At the moment, the foreign policy chief of the European Union, for example, is from Estonia, a country with, I think, about 1.3 million. Meanwhile, they have a seat at the table. Meanwhile, Russia, with 145 million, they do not have a seat. And then that begs the question, how do we recognize their security concerns? How do we accommodate this? And we don't. We don't even discuss Russian security concerns. It is quite remarkable. So one shouldn't be surprised that we end up in conflicts with the Russians if they're not represented, and we don't even talk about their security concerns.
And even now, when you think of it, the situation today, the United States is kind of going around Europe and talking to Russia. So it's kind of, Europe is out of the loop a little bit. Why do you think this has come to it?
Well, I think in this peace negotiations, I think the Europeans are seen as being unrealistic and unreliable by both Washington as well as Moscow. Now, this isn't even, it's worth noting that after the Russian invasion in 2022, you had President Macron of France. He actually tried to have some conversations with Putin, and the rest of the Europeans, they pulled him back, arguing, no, we don't do diplomacy with Russia. We're going to isolate them internationally. And he warned, actually, that, if we don't talk to the Russians, then peace in Europe will be negotiated by a non-European power, which is now the United States. So the Europeans, they kind of handed this over, and no one's preventing them from picking up the phone and calling Moscow. But for 3 years now, they boycotted diplomacy while all these hundreds of thousands of young men died on the front lines, and they still don't want to pick up the phone and call Russia and try to get in and start some diplomacy. Instead, the key impulse now seems to be to try to undermine what Trump was, not a perfect peace, obviously, but what he was pursuing.
Right, and at the same time, I think there is some sort of, disheveled look within the European Union regarding the issue of Ukraine. What policy are they exactly following right now?
I don't know, and I think this is a part of the problem. There's no strategic clarity. That is, it's not clear what they want to achieve. Some are saying that we can't negotiate, we have to win, but if we recognize that this is an issue, this is considered to be an existential threat to Russia, that means they will fight till the end, and Russia just happens to be the world's largest nuclear power. How exactly do we define victory? There is no victory, and indeed, what's been revealed is the Americans, they never really wanted to send so much weapon that they could destroy or defeat Russia, because that would be nuclear war. They realized this. They just sent enough weapons to bleed the Russians, that is, to send the Ukrainians to die and hope to kill some Russians and weaken a strategic adversary. But the idea that you can defeat Russia is foolish. So if you can't defeat the Russians, what is the goal? Are you going to negotiate with them? No, they don't want to do this either. You had the foreign policy chief talking about breaking Russia into pieces. They don't want to talk to Putin because they say he's a war criminal. So we don't do diplomacy. We want to take on the world's largest nuclear power. There's a lack of strategic thinking here, and I think this is really undermining our security in Europe.
And where do you think this is going now? How do you think this conflict is going to end?
Well, we're losing it.
What would you bet on?
Well, NATO is losing the war. We're running out of weapons and we're running out of Ukrainians. So it's just going to get worse every day we wait. So every day we wait, Ukrainians lose more men. We have even less weaponry. And the Ukrainians lose more infrastructure, more territory. So it's, the former advisor of Zelensky, Arestovich, he was saying we should take this deal by the Russians. That is neutrality and territorial concessions. And he recognized that if we don't give away four territories, we're going to lose eight. So I think in Europe, a key problem is there's wishful thinking. It's that we can't accept that Russia determines if Ukraine should be a part of NATO. So we're not going to let them have a voice. But if you don't let Russia have a voice, they will have to use military force, which is what they've done. If you don't accept a territorial concession, the alternative isn't to get all the territory back. It's to lose twice as much. And I think this is the problem. So people, they become very moralistic, and they take a very maximalistic position, and they think that this is somehow expresses their moral, because no, we will not accept one inch of Ukrainian territory lost. But if the alternative is hundreds of thousands of more Ukrainians dead, a nation destroyed, and even more territory lost, why is this moral? And no one seems to answer this.
Right. But do you think that if like wearing the shoes of Mr. Zelensky, for example, here, do you think that if this becomes sort of a pattern, if he agrees to this, anywhere else in the world there might be a conflict, and then easily say, okay, you want to settle down? Okay, this part of your country now belongs to the other country, to your neighbor. It's fine. People are not going to get killed. Don't you think that this is going to like change the whole shape, geopolitical shape of the entire world?
Well, that's the premise in which we see now many Western countries do not want to give any concessions to Russia, because the narrative is, this was an unprovoked invasion. The Russians invaded because they wanted territory. If we give them the territory, we right. reward them. So now we're sending a signal to the rest of the world, anyone can go and take territory. Yeah. So if you accept the premise, then it makes sense. My point is, I don't buy into the premise. Russia never invaded because it wanted territory.
Right.
They've been saying since the 90s, we need a proper inclusive European security architecture. Yeah. Because when you expand NATO closer and closer to the Russian borders, exactly, it's considered a threat. And it shouldn't be controversial. A lot of Western leaders, politicians, military leaders, intelligence officials, ambassadors, they all recognized throughout the years that this was an existential threat to the Russians. Even Angela Merkel once said that taking Ukraine into NATO would be considered a declaration of war against Russia. So we know that this wasn't about territory. The loss of territory is the symptom or the consequence of it. So I think if we recognize that the war started because Russia sees NATO expansion as an existential threat,
right,
then suddenly the lesson is very different. If we don't make any compromise now, it can only escalate, because there's no way Russia would ever accept NATO in Ukraine, or that Donbas should again fall into Ukrainian control. So one doesn't have to think this is just or good, but I think it's very dangerous, this premise we keep pushing, that right, this was unprovoked and that they just wanted territory.
Yeah.
It's again, it feels very moral, something we say, so we'll be the good guy, but it prevents yes. peace, because there's no solution to right. this conflict if we just say this is just the Russian imperialism.
Of course, Glenn, you know that the Ukraine conflict is not the only one currently in the world. We have the situation in the Middle East, in Gaza and Palestine, to be exact. Always the narrative, the mainstream narrative, is always that the collective West cares so much about issues like human rights issues, women and children issues, and that sort of stuff. But when it comes to the women and children in Gaza today, they seem to be, at the very best, indifferent. Why do you think this has become like this?
Well, as you said, I think the narratives become overwhelming. They're so dominant that facts have less to say. So, again, all narratives and all conflicts around the world have to be framed somehow as a struggle between good and evil. With the Russians we have one, but in the Middle East it's the same. If you have, for example, these tensions between Israel and Iran, then Israel is the liberal democracy, freedom, human rights. Iran is like a terrorist state. It's a big Taliban camp, essentially. This is how Iran is portrayed.
Yeah.
And once something is good versus evil, then people are often convinced that, you can look away from some of this collateral damage, because it's for a good cause. Often this would be the mindset. Now, I think, as you say, I think it's taking a... I think what's happened in Gaza has... ruined a lot of punched a hole in these narratives, because yes. it's very hard to explain how our foreign policies are organized around human rights, when one is assisting, not just looking the other way, but actually assisting a genocide. So watching all this, thousands of children being murdered, and still not mustering up the courage to criticize or call on restraints, but instead sending more weapons. I think this is, it's immensely problematic. I think a lot of people are waking up and figuring out something's not really right with this narrative. And that's just Gaza. You can look at Syria. The Americans had a bounty on the head of Jolani. And suddenly, the next day, he's our new friend and ally.
How quickly things change.
Very quickly. Didn't have time to remove the bounty on his head before making him before he was renovated.
Recognizing him.
Yeah, so no longer was he Al-Qaeda. He's now... he's now a reformist, and he puts on a new coat, a jacket, and suddenly, oh look, he's reformed, and all the newspapers push these ridiculous headlines, and I think many people was also appalled by what the EU did. That is, when the new authorities in Syria was massacring the Alawites, the EU actually went out with a tweet blaming the Alawites for provoking it. It's quite remarkable and it's so damaging for us as well, for the Europeans, because we were told that these values were central. It's what would bind all the Europeans together. It's what would define us. And then they show how little it's worth, that it can just be thrown away and dismissed in such a crude manner. So I think, again, it's horrible here for the region, of course, but it's also a lot of self-harm for the Europeans, because we're destroying who we were supposed to be.
Of course. And we mentioned Syria, of course. What do you think the situation in that country is going to end up like? Do you think it's going to be like what we witnessed in a certain period in Afghanistan?
I think it's going to be chaos. I think a lot of the partnerships you saw, they were only premised on being anti-Assad. There was a coalition of different countries and groups who wanted to have regime change, to topple him. So you have the United States, you have many of the Europeans, you have the Saudis, UAE, you have Turkey, you have Israel, all of them kind of playing a role. But once Assad is gone, the anti-Assad coalition is over. Now, what is the new Syria going to look like? And I think it's much more likely now that you're going to see a clash between the different actors. And you indeed, I think at the forefront of this, Israel and Turkey is definitely, Turkey would like to see Syria more or less a protectorate of Turkey. Israel, I think they want to carve it up into smaller pieces.
In the beginning, they looked like they were like allies in this. But now, day by day, they're like kind of facing up to one another. And I think it's another case of just trying to destroy a country in order to gain control, but for control to actually go out of your hands.
I don't think they planned. They had not an exit strategy, but I don't think they planned for the day after. Once the regime change is over, what now? And I think this exposes how little they have in common. I mean, the idea that Israel and Turkey would have a common future, a vision for what Syria should look like, it was always foolish. I remember I wrote an article right after Assad was toppled and pointed out this is, the anti-Assad alliance is over. This is, they're going to start to have more tensions. And what about the Americans? How will they, they will probably want to lean more in towards the supporting the Kurds. That will also go against the government there. So, I think it's going to be a huge mess.
This is a very interesting conversation, Glenn. We'll be back after a quick break. I want to talk about, you did a dissertation on EU and NATO relations with Russia. I want to see, of course, nowadays everybody is speaking of forming a new military force in Europe because of the 2% argument for the US and everything. How feasible do you think that idea is?
2%? Well, it would have been more feasible before. Now Europe is in a deep economic crisis. Now, on principle, I would think it's a good idea, but it depends. It depends to what's end, to what end. Yeah. If Europe spends military and becomes more self-sufficient, America, then I think it's going to be a positive thing, because when you have huge security dependence on the United States, it will use the security dependence to extract the political concessions, economic loyalty. And this is not. This is why the Europeans often do things which are against their own interest. So if we arm ourselves and push and say, you know, make the Americans, you know, step aside or, you know, go home, then I think this could be positive, because then at least we would use our military to enhance our own national interest. But I don't see this happening. I think it's we're just going to add this to the United States arsenal and look for more military solutions. And from my perspective, that would be, yeah, the worst we can do now, because this was the curse of the unipolar moment. You know, usually the point of departure in security strategy is you want to mitigate or reduce security competition. You can't just have two countries, more weapon is more security. No, you have to reduce the security concerns of your opponents as well. This is usually what security strategies are about. Instead, hegemonic international order, you're so overwhelmingly dominant that no one can, you know, doesn't matter if they're fearful, they can't do anything anyways. This is the hegemonic order. We have to move away from this. This is why when we have conflicts with the Russians, the first impulse is, well, how can we defeat them? But as I said before, the solution, you know, first you pick up the phone to find out if it's necessary to fight this war. And we haven't done this.
Exactly. Thinking about the European pattern, how possible do you think there would be for the Middle East to have the same sort of regional kind of togetherness and unity from a matter, from a perspective of international relations, sort of convergence?
Well, it should be possible. I mean, we often see, for example, the Gulf states and Iran have tensions, but if you see the things that unite them versus what divides, it's there shouldn't be these tensions to begin with. I think, again, a key curse is how do you organize the international system? And it's been kind of common sense, not anymore, the past 30 years, but it's always been common sense that peacetime alliances are a terrible thing for stability, because it perpetuates conflicts. The entire internal structure and power depends on conflicts continuing. And the problem with the hegemonic order is it's dependent on alliance systems. So look at the United States. As long as you have some tensions between Iran and the Gulf states will be dependent on the United States. Yes. They will have economic, political loyalties because of security dependence, and you can contain and weaken Iran. Now, if peace breaks out, suddenly, you know, Iran's not contained. The Gulf states will start to act more independently of the United States. So there's always this need to perpetuate tensions. And you saw this when the Chinese, because they're not going for hegemony. They wanted to do economic... you know, connectivity with Iran, but also not alienating the Gulf states. So for them, they had an incentive to improve ties. And this is what they did. They were pushing for better relations. And you saw what was the first thing that happened? I saw a former Mossad chief writing an article that, you know, oh, if the Gulf states are not going to be part of this anti-Iranian alliance, maybe we should try to make peace with the Iranians too. And suddenly, it looks like peace might break out. But then, what is the hegemonic role of the United States? So there's always this need for conflicts and tension. And at the end of the day, I don't think it's good for the United States either. I think they're throwing away the republic in the pursuit of empire. And they're going to lose both at the end. So I think this would be a positive some solution. Just find a way of transitioning away from alliance systems, block politics, and try to move into some inclusive security architecture, because, you know, both Iran and, for example, Saudi Arabia have a lot of grievances, but you're going to live in the same neighborhood. You're going to have to, you know, it's in your interest to find a way of living together in a good way. America's away. They don't live here. They don't have that same interest, same as in Europe. They don't have, now that the war went wrong in Ukraine, the continent is on fire, they can go home, which they are. Yeah. And so you should always prioritize your neighbors first and find some inclusive arrangements.
option for today and a better tomorrow. IRIB English Radio. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en.
Ask the followers of the remembrance if ye know not.
You are listening to the program The Key on Iran Radio with Sheikh Shiraz.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Welcome to our program The Key here at IRIB English Radio. Today on The Key, we're going to be looking at a very important topic, and that topic is related to the days that we are currently in. I am speaking, of course, of the Ayyam Fatimiyya, the days when we mourn the Lady Fatima and her martyrdom. As you know, tomorrow marks the anniversary of her martyrdom. For this reason, on behalf of IRIB English Radio and The Key, we would like to offer our esteemed listeners condolences on this very sad and momentous occasion. In connection with this topic, the question we want to pose today is, how did Imam Ali alayhi salam mourn the Lady Fatima? How did he express his grief for her? In order to answer this question, we can take recourse to a famous hadith which has been narrated. In this hadith, Imam Ali expresses certain things after he buried the Lady Fatima. When burying Fatima alayha as-salam, Imam Ali alayhi salam said this, O Prophet of Allah, he addressed the Prophet of Allah, his grave. Addressing it, he said, O Prophet of Allah, peace be upon you from me and from your daughter, who is joining you and who has hastened to meet you. O Prophet of Allah, my patience with the demise of your chosen one, meaning your daughter, has been exhausted, and my power of endurance has weakened. Except that I have ground for consolation in having endured the great hardship and heart-rending event of your separation. Meaning, you know, the separation from the Prophet was even greater than this. So the Imam is saying that I had experienced that and had prepared me for this sad event. I laid you down in your grave when your last breath had passed, when your head was between my neck and chest. Indeed, we belong to Allah, and to Him do we return. The Imam recited this verse of the Holy Quran, Inna lillah wa inna ilayhi raji'un. Then he said, Now the trust has been returned, and what had been given has been taken back. As to my grief, it knows no bounds, and as to my nights, they will remain sleepless till Allah chooses me for the house in which you are now residing. Certainly, your daughter will apprise you of the gathering of your community in oppressing her. You ask her in detail and get all the news about the situation. This happened when a long time had not even elapsed since your demise, and your remembrance had not ceased. My salutations be on both of you. The salutation of one grief-stricken, not a disgusted or hateful person. For if I go away, it is not because I am weary of you, and if I stay, it is not due to the lack of belief in what Allah has promised the endurers. These were some of the great words of Imam Ali alayhi salam, when she mentioned after he buried the Lady Fatima, and in mourning her and remembering that great lady. And it's interesting that in this hadith, the Imam alayhi salam, You know, he likens and equates the grief that he endured with the grief he endured at the demise of the Prophet, which reminds us of the famous prophetic hadith where the Prophet said, Fatima is a part of me and is the light of my eyes and the fruit of my heart. Right? So the Prophet kind of equated himself with her and said, affirmed the affinity between them. Thank you for joining us here on The Key. We were looking at how Imam Ali alayhi salam mourned the Lady Fatima. Until next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
You just listened to the program The Key on Iran Radio with Sheikh Shiraz.
You can also send your questions to English Radio at irib.ir.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Beruba Shavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pureza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with the reporters.
Yemen's health minister Ali Shayban paints a stark picture of a health system suffocating under siege. Medicines are vanishing, chronic patients are deteriorating, children are dying before help can reach them. He called the shutdown of Sana'a International Airport a crime against humanity, especially after Israeli strikes destroyed its capacity, cutting off the only viable route for life-saving drugs. Families now face a brutal reality. No airport means no treatment, and no treatment means lives lost.
Today, we renew our call for the United Nations to operate flights and reopen Sana'a International Airport to save thousands of patients who urgently need to travel abroad for treatment. More than 250,000 patients require medical travel for serious and life-threatening conditions. Over 1,330 types of essential medicines, including immune therapies and other critical drugs, have not been allowed into the country due to the air blockade.
The ministry says thousands have been deprived of essential medications due to the air blockade. It warns that inaction would cause more deaths that can be simply prevented.
The continued closure of Sana'a International Airport clearly proves that the international humanitarian and health organizations that constantly preach about human rights are fully politicized and operate under American and Israeli influence. The clearest example is what is happening in Yemen, where thousands of people urgently need to travel for treatment but remain unable to do so as the airport remains closed to this moment.
Israel struck Sana'a International Airport in early May this year, damaging its runway, terminal, and several aircraft. The regime struck the facility again as Yemen continued its military operations against Israeli targets in response to its war on Gaza. Yemen's health ministry says the reopening of the airport, once a lifeline for the population, is an urgent humanitarian obligation, not a political convenience.
The health crisis continues to escalate as life-saving medicines remain blocked from entering the country. Officials warn that unless urgent steps are taken to restore medical access, thousands of vulnerable patients will face worsening conditions with no alternative options. Abdul Latif Loshali, Sana'a.
The latest U.S. jobs reports paints a bleak portrait of the American economy under President Donald Trump. Newly released data showed the unemployment rate climbed to 4.4% in September, its highest level since October 2021, signaling a labor market losing momentum. Industries once considered pillars of the American economy are faltering. Transportation and warehousing shed more than 25,000 jobs, while manufacturing lost another 6,000 positions. The report itself was delayed for weeks due to the government shutdown, a disruption triggered by political brinkmanship in Washington. Its release now lands alongside troubling inflation data. Manual inflation in September reached its highest reading since January, confirming that prices are accelerating at their fastest pace of the year. Economists point to one major culprit behind rising costs: Trump's aggressive and increasingly erratic tariff regime. Since returning to office, he has slapped steep import taxes on goods from dozens of countries, including long-standing allies. Instead of reviving American industry, the tariffs have pushed production costs upward and left consumers footing the bill. Trump had promised Americans that prices would fall on day one of his presidency. Instead, a clear majority now report that their expenses have surged. Despite Trump's repeated insistence that there is virtually no inflation, a new Harris poll shows Americans continuing to feel financial strain and growing more pessimistic about the economic direction of the country. The data underscore their frustration. The typical American household now spends $208 more dollars every month just to purchase the same basket of goods and services as a year earlier, and more than $1,000 more per month compared with early 2021 when the nation was emerging from the pandemic. Now, many analysts believe that if the Trump administration continues doubling down on these policies, the financial pressure will only spread. Higher prices, fewer job opportunities, and a shrinking margin of stability for millions of households already stretched thin.
Iran Geo 2025 opening its doors to the public. The event that has rapidly become the country's main platform for showcasing advances in mapping, satellite imaging, GIS systems, and spatial data technologies. This year, for the first time, the Armed Forces Geographical Organization and the National Mapping Organization of Iran have joined hands to bring the entire geospatial ecosystem under one roof.
When governance is founded on information and knowledge, geospatial data becomes a powerful tool. Exhibitions like Iran Geo help us shape sound strategies and prevent future crises. Accurate spatial data reduces imbalances and supports smarter long-term planning. These technologies let us look ahead, not just react to problems, and that makes a lasting contribution to the country.
Knowledge-based firms filling several halls demonstrating AI.